We're going to talk today again about Romans 9, the last half of the chapter. This will finish our talk on Romans 9. It is a very difficult chapter to get through. It's been a little difficult for me to try to straighten out, to kind of see exactly what Paul was trying to say here and trying to make sense of it in the light of what my responsibilities and what obligations I have as a human being. Looking a little bit at the last session that we had, we found out, according to what Paul has said here, that God is sovereign. That's a point that Paul is trying to make, that God can do anything he wants to do, and there is no power on earth or in heaven or anywhere that can challenge him. The one good thing about that is that God is right. He's righteous. He does things that are right. He knows every time the exact way to do it perfectly right. Now, it doesn't always make sense to us, but it's certainly something we cannot challenge. Now, that's a little difficult for some of us that are rather independent to think that there is something greater than us that we cannot challenge, that we cannot make up our own mind on. Like Frank Sinatra used to say, we like to have it our way. We like to do it our way. So what I guess one of the big questions here is, what does God allow us to do? What decisions does he allow for us to do? And that's where the rubber meets the road, and that's where the problem is. Everybody has a different view of what God will allow us to do ourselves. What is our responsibility and what is his? You know, and we call this what? Kind of a predetermined life? Where God exercises sovereignty almost totally, and we're just kind of pawns that go through life, and whatever he has decided, that's the way it goes. And then there's those that think that we have a lot more latitude than that, that we are able to make choices, big choices, that God allows us big chunks of responsibility. Now, how do you bring those two together? Because they both seem to have an argument. Well, you know, it's almost like physics. In physics, we know that we all know about visible light, but yet try to define visible light is a very difficult thing to do. So at one time, people thought it was a wave, you know, a frequency, and they tried to describe it according to a frequency, but there was a limitation. They couldn't quite get the job done. So they went to a particle theory, and they decided to talk about it as little photons of light, little packages of light. And you know, they got a long ways with that. They were able to kind of fill in the rough spots using the particle theory, but the particle theory fell apart when it came to the wave theory, you know, when it came to the points where the wave theory was strong. And I almost believe, no, I don't almost believe, I believe that that's the way it is with this thing of the sovereignty of God and how he exercises it in our life. I believe that it is beyond our ability to understand completely, to bring it all together, to finally say, hey, this is the puzzle. I brought all the pieces together, and this is it, folks. I really believe that it is beyond us to do that. I wonder sometimes if we spend too much time focusing on our differences in that area and not taking enough time to focus on, well, what do we do about it? What can we do? We do know that God exercises his sovereign will in many areas of our life. Now, we're safe on this ground because it's pretty firm ground. How about the family you were born in? How much choice did you have about the family you were born in? How about your intelligence? Now, we can cultivate everything that God has given us, but there's a limit. None of us, I shouldn't say none of us, there's a few of you, very, very few, that are going to have the intelligence of Einstein. How about our position in life? Many times it's determined a lot about our ambitions and so on. And there's certain things that are determined here by God. Our gender, God has created people, man and woman. And we have little choice on that. We have no choice on that. How about our personalities? Today, scientists, psychologists are beginning to understand that we are born with a certain amount of personality. Now, it can be shaped, and the situations of life have a great deal of impact on it, but there is something there right from birth. How about as far as attractiveness? How about as far as physical characteristics? Some of us are tall, some of us are short. How about as far as attractiveness? You know, they're just, I mean, are we, some are ugly, some are beautiful. We don't have a lot of choice in that. Now, we can use our willpower to maintain our weight, and we can do different things like that. But as far as actually the form of our face and the form of our body, a lot of that comes right from birth. It is God's sovereign will being exercised. Health, you know, today they're finding out that there's an envelope that we have to live in our health. We are predetermined, predisposed, genetically predisposed towards a certain amount of health. We can only live so long. Some people will live a lot longer than others. So there was one gentleman when I was in eighth grade, the teacher brought him in. I think he was 95 and he could still do, you know, stand on his head and he would do all kinds of things like that there. And we asked him, well, what is the secret to your, you know, your long age like this here and your health? And he said, well, I smoke a cigar every day. And I think that's the answer. And we all, of course, chuckled. Obviously, this was not the answer to his health. It was God's sovereign will that he would be healthy. He lived within a very high genetic envelope. So there are some things that God has predetermined, predisposed us to. Now, he also uses people for examples. Now, you're going to be used as an example, my friend, and so am I. Now, you can be a good example or you can be a bad example, but God, I promise you, will use you for some type of example. What does that mean? Well, in this chapter, he talked a little bit about Pharaoh. He was a leader in Egypt years ago, a very powerful man, and God wanted to bring his people out of Egypt, and Pharaoh stood in the way. Now, first of all, Pharaoh was a fool to stand in the way of God. He obviously didn't know God or know very much about him. Either that or his intelligence level was very, very low. But, you know, God knows the beginning from the end. He knows that. And he knew what Pharaoh was going to do. And this is a gray area, I know. But this is the only defense I can have that shows that Pharaoh was more than just a pawn. He knew, God knew what Pharaoh was going to do with his life. As he knows, again, the beginning from the end. And so if Pharaoh was going to mess up his life and make the wrong choices, why not use him for a poor example so that other people could see and maybe learn to know God better? Avoid the same trap that Pharaoh fell into. I believe that God does this. And I don't believe that it's necessarily because he wants to just use someone as a pawn. I think he knows kind of what these people are going to do. Well, I know he knows that. And he can use them for some kind of example for the rest. But one thing I will say to you, my friend, no matter what role God has put you in this life, that is not the big issue. The issue is this, that no matter what our role, we all have the same value in God's sight. No matter what you are, male, female, intelligent, unintelligent, ugly, beautiful, gifted, ungifted, I don't care what it is. God is no respecter of persons. He values you as much as anybody else in this world. One of the problems that crop up when we try to determine what God's sovereign will is for us, what he's allowed us to do and what he's allowed us not to do, is the idea of understanding it all and then believing. I call that the fatal loop, because you cannot understand it all and then believe. Satan uses this constantly with intelligent people. He tells them that they must understand it all, and then they can believe and get a grasp on it. But that can't happen because we've got too small of a brain. It's like in New York. If you go into the tracks there, I think it's a Grand Central Station, they make no sense in a way. You can't believe that anybody could really control what's going on there. It looks like confusion to the greatest degree. But there is a control room where everybody can see the tracks and where the trains are, and it all begins to make sense. Human beings many times never arrive at that. Things happen in our lives. People die, are taken from us. Something happens to us, and we can't really explain it. If we have to explain it before we will believe, we will never truly believe. So we want to stay out of that. And how do we stay out of that? Well, first of all, we can't understand this thing. It's too big of an issue for us. But we can look in the Bible and we can find promises. And I'm going to challenge each one of you to get your Bibles out and start reading through it and mark every promise that you come to that says that you have the right or the power to be able to, or at least implies that, to be able to come to know the Lord. And if you don't know Him, after you read those promises, I hope you become fixed in the Lord, that you will surrender to Him. Let me read a few here on Joshua. He says, "And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourself this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river or the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." He didn't say this as if they couldn't make a choice. He said it as if they were able to make that choice. This was an amplified version too. And I'll read 1 John 5:10. "He who believes in the Son of God has a testimony within himself. He who does not believe God has made him out to be and represented him as a liar, because he does not believe, puts his faith and adheres to and relies on the evidence, the testimony that God has borne regarding his Son." Again, as if it's a choice. Jude 1:5. "Now I want to remind you, though you are fully informed once for all, that though the Lord delivered people out of the land of Egypt, he subsequently destroyed those who did not believe." Okay, he didn't destroy those that were pawns or determined to be that way, but who didn't believe, as if we have a choice. And Deuteronomy 1:32, "Yet in spite of this word, you did not believe the Lord your God." Again, as if we have a choice. And in John 6:69, "And we have learned to believe and trust, and we have come to know that you are the Holy One of God, the Christ, the Anointed One, the Son of the living God." And in John 11:26, "And whoever continues to believe, whoever continues to live and believes in, has faith in, cleaves to, and relies on me shall never die at all. Do you believe this?" And on and on. I mean, I could read, and we've read some before in the first part of 9. The promises are there. They promise that if we will believe, if we will trust, that we will find the Lord. And the last point I want to make is that point of experiential, what has really happened? Okay, we can talk about theoretical things and we can read the promises and we should and cling to them, because these are promises from God and we have to trust that he said them and that he is telling the truth. But in the days of Charles Finney back in the 1800s, there was a lot of this predestination thing, this election thing. Now we know there's something to it, but they took it too far. They believed that God was going to transform them physically or something, and they just kind of waited for him to do it. And what was religion like in those days? How fervent was Christianity? How much passion was there? There was very little. There was a low ebb of Christianity. And when Finney came in, he talked differently. He told them that they had a choice and that they were not to wait for, you know, God to do it all for them, that there was a certain part that they had to do too. And by doing that, we had the second great awakening in the United States. It just caught on. People came to the Lord and they chose to serve the Lord, and it grew, and there was a huge, huge revival in those days. So I'm going to read you just a little bit about what Charles Finney says. Now again, this is in their language in those days, so it's a little bit hard to understand at times. But he says, "Instead of telling sinners to use the means of grace and pray for a new heart, we call on them to make themselves a new heart and spirit and press the duty of instant surrender to God. We told them the Spirit was striving with them to induce them now to give him their hearts, now to believe and to enter once upon a life devoted to Christ of faith and love and Christian obedience. We taught them that while they were praying for their own convictions of duty, they would be Christians. We tried to show them that everything they did or said before they had submitted, believed, given their hearts to God was all sin, was not that which God required them to do, but was simply deferring repentance and resisting the Spirit. I would like to read you a story that was attributed to Abraham Lincoln, and maybe it helps us to understand a little bit more about how we are to serve the Lord. We are to give him our heart. We have a debt to pay to the Lord, and of course it's more than a debt, but there's a duty that we have to do. There's something we have to do. We're not a potted plant. There's something we have to do in all of this process. Let me read you this story. A story is told of his interview with William Scott, a boy from a Vermont farm, who, after marching 48 hours without sleep, volunteered to stand guard for a sick companion. Weariness overcame him, and he was found asleep at his post within gunshot of the enemy. He was tried and sentenced to be shot. Mr. Lincoln heard of the case and went himself to the tent where young Scott was kept under guard. He talked to him kindly, asking about his home, his schoolmates, and particularly about his mother. The lad took her picture from his pocket and showed it to him without speaking. Mr. Lincoln was much affected. As he rose to leave, he laid his hand on the prisoner's shoulder. "My boy," he said, "you are not going to be shot tomorrow. I believe you when you tell me that you were not able to stay awake. I am going to trust you and send you back to your regiment. Now I want to know how you intend to pay for all of this." The lad, overcome with gratitude, could hardly say a word, but crowding down his emotions, managed to answer that he did not know. He and his people were poor. They didn't have anything. They couldn't pay it. There was his pay and a little in the savings bank. They could borrow something, of course, and mortgage their farm. Perhaps his comrades would help. If Mr. Lincoln would wait until payday, possibly he could get together $500 or $600. Would that be enough? The kindly president shook his head. "My bill is a great deal more than that," he said. "It is a very large one. Your friends cannot pay it, nor your family, nor your farm. There is only one man in the world who can pay it, and his name is William Scott. If from this day he does his duty, so that when he comes to die, he can truly say, 'I have kept the promise I gave the president. I have done my duty as a soldier,' then the debt will be paid." Young Scott went back to his regiment, and the debt was fully paid a few months later, for he fell in battle.